We're talking everything an investor needs to understand before actually getting involved in the markets with Ted Oakley. He is a founder and partner of Oxbow Advisors. Ted, welcome back to Kitco.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
Ted, you are also an author, and I learned this after our last show together. And you sent me your latest book. It's called Your Money Mentality, How You Feel About Risk, Losses, and Gains. And so there's a lot of different topics covered in your book, but I'd like to touch on a few of them with the audience today. The first being the major market risks today that investors should pay attention to. And also, we'll talk about, I don't want to call it a self-help guide, but it is sort of, in a way, a guide towards understanding yourself as an investor, understanding your own risk tolerances, understanding how to position yourself, and understanding how to execute on your ideas. Very important and timely for today. So let's start with the major risks. You highlighted the main risks that would plague any market today. I'm just going to list a few, including credit risk, market risk, currency risk, inflation risk, real estate risk, concentration risk, among others. Ted, what is the highest, in your opinion, the highest rated risk right now?
I think, David, the highest risk right now is in actually the stock market. Now, I think real estate's risky too at this level. Everything's, I would say we're in a period where we call it everything speculative, and that's true. Almost everything's speculative. Private businesses are selling for speculative prices, but the markets are selling for prices that actually have never existed before. And the problem with that is that when you get to this point and everybody keeps on speculating and keeps on working, they just speculate more. So that's where we feel like we are and at this point, because I could take any measurement of that, price to sales on the market or forward price earnings, I could price to book value, and just look at all the speculative activity and as well as the number of companies. I mean, there's so many companies that are at these exorbitant prices that are losing money or not making any money. And so I think people, they've just gotten complacent. And I think the biggest risk right now is in that area.
In the tech bubble, we saw similar valuations in terms of bubbly prices. When you look at price to sales, price to earnings, EV, EBITDA, and so on. But back then we had a lot of companies that didn't do anything. They were just poor quality companies. Can you say the same today? I mean, it's one thing for the markets to be expensive because of monetary stimulus or because of increased speculation, like you said, but maybe the companies themselves are actually, you know, in good shape. What do you think?
Well, I think the problem with that, but to compare it to 99 is this, and I know I remember it greatly because we sold some of our last tech stocks in the fall of 99, and we actually lost some business. We had some people move accounts because they didn't like that. It paid off well the next 3 years, but we were certainly against the grain. Today, what you have is different. You have, then you had a lot of value stocks and things like that that were okay, but today you have a tremendous amount of companies that really have no value. They're just trading. I mean, look at the last two electric car companies that have come out here. If you look at Rivian and Lucid, I mean, here are companies that have nothing, and yet they have these billion-dollar market caps or more. And that's what we see today. We see this unbelievable amount of buying into things that don't have any value at this point. I'm not saying they wouldn't later on, but if you remember back in the 99, early 2000 era, you had a lot of companies that were selling. If you look at AOL and Yahoo and those companies, I mean, those companies lost 80% of their value, 80, 85%. Were they still around afterwards? Yeah, they were. But things, they really weren't worth the money. And that's what I'm saying. Yes, there'll probably be a number of these companies around. I think a number of them won't be around. But I think that's where we are today.
I'm guessing, Ted, you didn't buy Rivian?
I did not.
You did not.
I can't buy. You know, the Would thing about it, David, yeah. I can't buy companies that don't have any revenue. I mean, you know, from a business standpoint, and I do a lot of private investing too, I would never go out and buy a company that didn't have any revenue. You know,
so you wouldn't speculate on maybe a junior miner, for example, or a startup tech company?
I will tell you this, the only way I would do that is if I knew the owner, knew the founder really well. because when you invest in companies, you need to invest in the people. And since I don't know anybody in Raytheon or anything like that, obviously I wouldn't do that. But when I do and look at private companies, I always look at the people. Do I know the people? Do I know what they're capable of? And that's a little different situation than the public sector. But now in the public sector, you can just come up with a great idea and come out with it and put it, package it and come out. And all of a sudden, you're public.
Well, somebody's issuing, these IPOs. Somebody's doing the fundraising. Somebody's buying these shares. Sure. Where's the money coming from, Ted? Where's all this liquidity coming from?
Well, the liquidity's coming in after the last year and a half. You know, when you keep pushing money in the system and you have the Fed keep buying the bonds like they have, it's put a situation to where rates are so low, you can borrow for nothing. And so not only is there a lot of cash, but there's a lot of easy borrowing going on. And I would say, David, not to ever underestimate Wall Street, that they can sell anything. I started in New York City. I know what it's like, and they can sell anything there is as long as they can make a buck.
Can you sell me this pen, Ted?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, if they could underwrite it, they probably would.
I want to talk about the stock market risks one more time, and then we'll get back to some of the other risks you noted. Now, stock markets, of course, valuations have been high for a while, but let me just posit this argument, okay? I've heard the statement that stock markets are overvalued. I've been hearing that since, I graduated from university in 2012. So 2012, back then, after the financial crisis ended, stocks went up and people were saying, well, look, it's P's, I've never been higher. And of course, it continued to just grind higher even after that. If you had sold back then on fears of a bubbly market, you would have missed out on 10 years of gains. Is it different this time?
Well, I think it's different at this level. Now, the big mantra has been, David, over the last 10 years is that with interest rates where they are, then markets are not overvalued. My argument to that would be, let me take you back to 1982, when you had the earnings yield on the S&P at a level that was, and you had to look at the 10-year bond. And by the way, at that point, that would have told you that the market was the most overvalued ever. But it actually was really, really cheap. So the argument that interest rates should drive those multiples, we don't buy into. We just look at, okay, if you buy a company, how long is it going to take me to get my investment back? And on the other side, another strategy we use, how much cash flow am I going to receive annually? That's the way we look at it. Now, you can make an argument, people can, that, hey, I like to buy these things expensive because the rates are so low that it makes sense for me to get an earnings yield that's better. Well, that may make sense if you're just comparing those two things, but it doesn't make any sense when you're looking at buying a business, and that's what we're looking at.
So what's going to happen to the stock market then from here on?
Well, I think at some point, and this has to do with the Fed, when they quit buying and you don't have that holding up everything in the bonds, you know, on the whole thing, and you can tell that they've been really tepid. I mean, they sort of, you know, tiptoed into the thing and they think they got it all under control. They don't, but they think they do. And so what happens is when that goes down to zero, or you go down a lot lower than we are, you don't have that underpinning the market anymore. So when the fixed income markets start to be under pressure regarding that, then you'll probably see the equity market under pressure as well. But, everything gets to a point where all of a sudden it just drops on its own weight. And that's what you usually see at the top of a market. There's not a reason. It just starts off.
Has that happened before in your career where the Fed pulls the plug and the stock markets just collapse?
Well, I'll give you an example. If you go back to Greenspan in the 1987 break, okay, he thought, well, I'm going to be another Paul Volcker. And so I'm going to really hit this. We didn't really have that. Inflation was actually going down. It ticked up. But he thought, well, I'm going to really hit this inflation. So he got the bonds up to where the yield was 10%. And every portfolio manager said, why am I buying stocks? I'm selling the market because I've got the treasury at 10 points.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened. That's what causes those things. It really wasn't the case in 2000. I think in 2000, just the weight of the market itself, you know, you get to certain points and all of a sudden you roll over. But one of the problems now is that you can't get a clean look at it until the Fed backs out of the market. Then you get a clean look.
Right. What about credit risk? Are we seeing excessive leverage in our financial system? Are we seeing a buildup of potentially the next Lehman disaster?
Well, I don't know if you have another Lehman. I do think this, though. I think that there's leverage, too much leverage everywhere, and nobody's afraid of it. Last Thursday, I saw the announcements where the California Pension Funds, CalPERS, had decided that in addition to all their alternative investments, which they probably don't know where all of those are, they're going to leverage. Now, if I'm a person and I've got a pension plan that's decided to leverage, I think I'd retire and take the money out and then go back part-time or something. I wouldn't do that, though. So everybody's getting leveraged here. And you look at the leverage levels and nobody's afraid of it because rates are so low, they can say, well, look at the cost of debt here. It's really low. But eventually, you know, it has to be paid back if you're a company or you go under. But yeah, I think there's too much leverage everywhere. Real estate, private businesses, private equity, too much leverage in every spot.
Okay. Inflation risk, I know it's not your top risk right now, but you did mention in the book. I'm just going to read this sentence. Most people, or many of today's investors, have never witnessed inflation. As a consequence, when it does arrive, and it will, we will have a lot of people who will have no idea where the risks lie. Now, you wrote this book a few months ago. Inflation's now at 6.2%. So I'm guessing when you wrote it, you had foreseen inflation to go higher. I think that's the underlying assumption. This is the highest inflation level since the early 90s. In fact, the last time we had this high of an inflation level, I was still learning how to walk. So you're right. A lot of people, especially from my generation, have never seen this before. What should we do? You've outlined a few solutions in that chapter, buying hard assets, for example. But generally, the message that you're trying to give is that most people don't know how to react. Why is that a problem, though? Why can't they just learn?
Well, they can learn. The problem is that they'll lose buying. You know, the whole idea, David, behind investing is to maintain buying power over decades. If you can maintain buying power with your assets at the same level through inflationary periods, that's the whole idea behind investing. That means I've got as much money on an inflationary basis 30 years from now that I have now. And what happens is a lot of people now, especially people in the business, investment business, they're buying long bonds, 20, 25, 30 year bonds. They're not getting much money on them. But I was in a period in investing in the bond market where you bought a bond and 3 months later, it was probably going to be lower in price because you kept on inflating all the time. And so you had to learn how to work around that. What happens now is everybody that is in the marketplace, especially investors, but also a lot of people in investment business have not seen it. And what happens during inflation is, I'll just tell you, it becomes more of a commoditized investment atmosphere. You have to be able to trade a little bit more. Like, we're not big traders or anything like that. But what happens is during moves where inflation's moving higher all the time, financial assets don't do as well, but they have these spurts. They'll go up and they'll trade higher and then they'll trade back because every time they get going and inflation keeps pushing up, it becomes a problem. Now, I'm not saying we'll go through that like we did in the late 70s and early 80s. Again, I don't think we'll get that high at all, but if you get to 3 or 4% inflation and just stick with it right there, there has to be some changes going on because everybody's all of a sudden in a negative real rate situation still.
Mm-hmm. So given that we might be persisting into a negative real interest rate environment, given that inflation is a risk, given that the stock markets are an even bigger risk in your opinion, what should investors do? What should they buy?
Well, I think they have to be balanced in this respect. I don't think they can just say, okay, I want to go all hard assets or all commodities. I think they've got to have some of everything. But particularly, I think they need to keep for a while, and maybe not later on, but for a while, they need to keep their bond maturity shorter than they normally would. And in fact, very short. I think the other side of it is they have to own some assets that are inflation sensitive. For us, for example, we own oil, we own natural gas, we own fertilizer, we own timber. We own metals. And so we have that, but it's not 100%. It's a balanced look so that we've got a chance to participate if, in fact, you keep this inflationary look going. One of the things that's up in the air is the inflation's coming from energy, housing, and food. That's where we're getting it. If that, in fact, changes and we slow that down, then that's going to change the atmosphere. But right now, those three things are really driving the bus right now.
Okay, well, do you think that a stock market correction is imminent, potentially in the next 2 years?
I do. I would guess that we'll have some sort of a bear market within the next 2 years. If you ask me a yes or no question, I would say yes.
Would it be as bad as 2008, bad as last year?
Well, usually from this level, if you look at your standard deviations of valuation relative to where the market is, and you just go back to an average of where it should be, you know, that's probably right now somewhere between a 40 and 50% break. Now, I'm not predicting it's going to be 50%, but I have to tell you, it wouldn't surprise me only because you go back, everybody believe right now, they think you can't go back to the norms. Well, you always go back to the norms eventually. Yeah. Might not be this year or next year, but that's what happens in investing. That's why it works the way it works. And so some point in time, you'll go back to some basic, those sorts of valuations. That doesn't necessarily bother me because I think people need to realize if you have liquidity in those times, that's where you really make a lot of money. And I think we always look at it as an opportunity.
Now, many fund managers in the business today entered the business after 2008, which means that a lot of people haven't seen or witnessed a prolonged bear market. What we saw last year was unprecedented, but the stock markets rebounded very quickly thereafter. I'm not saying it didn't wipe a lot of people out. I'm just saying it wasn't a prolonged bear market. So if we do have a bear market that persists for longer than 2 months, what's the consequence of having an industry where a lot of managers aren't experienced with that kind of environment?
I think the biggest thing, David, is this. If you look at the people that have come into this business over the last 12 to 14 years, they come into a situation where they all buy index funds, they all buy exchange-traded funds. They plug what I call plug and play. They buy 10 assets and say, hey, just don't worry about it. It's great on the long run and everything will be fine. Well, the last 10 years, that actually has been true. I can't argue with it. However, when you go into a bear market that lasts a year and a half or 2 years, it's cruel. It takes down the best stocks. It takes down the worst stocks. It takes down everything. You can have the best stocks on the board and bear markets take them all down. And the thing that they probably wouldn't understand in that is that it wears people down over time. And the people that have been around the last 12 years or so haven't had a chance to be worn down yet. So what happens is they'll get very frustrated and their investors will get frustrated because they didn't have any liquidity. So many of them today, we see portfolios all the time, zero liquidity, you know. And there's no insurance policy whatsoever at something going wrong. So I think that'll be the biggest problem for those people in that situation.
One of the chapters in your book discusses understanding yourself as an investor, understanding your own risk tolerances, understanding your own control systems that you can utilize in that kind of situation. How do you come about understanding yourself? This is not an easy thing to do for most people. Like you mentioned, right, last year, one of your examples was in March last year when the stock markets crashed at the onset of COVID. A lot of your clients sold off at the low because they couldn't stomach the volatility. I'm just thinking about your example of what an inexperienced fund manager might do. So how do you come to understand how to basically hedge yourself in that kind of environment?
Well, David, if when you look at the book, right in the very beginning, I say, look, if you don't read the whole book, read these two things. And one of them is the last chapter, which is basically, what is your choking point? Now, everybody, no matter how risky they are or conservative they are, has a point to where they want X amount of dollars not to go any further. No, there is a point. Even the most risky people we know can get shaken up if they lose enough money. And so what happens is I tell everybody, look, whatever is in your psyche, there's a dollar amount in there that says, okay, I want this amount of money to always be, and we call it, we have two, an idea. We have base capital and we have investment capital. And we always say on this base capital side, there's a certain amount of money that you need to keep out of the market. You need to keep it very, very solid. It's not volatile at all. That's the number that will allow you to go through the ups and downs of the market with your investment capital and not shake you out.
Yeah.
If you have everything in the market all of a sudden and you think, gosh, I've had people tell me this before. I never thought my capital would go down to this level. Well, It's because they didn't have, you have to be able to live to play another day and survive.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key point in investing is that if you get in a position where all of a sudden the market's controlling you because you've hit that point. That we're, mm-hmm. You know what? I can't take it. For young people, I think they always should have some money there. They can have more money in the market because they put more money in all the time. But that's what we look at. I think you have to get to that number. And if you can realize what that number is, okay, that's a number I want, then everything else will work for you.
Okay, well, let me give you a hypothetical example. Suppose I have $20,000 of capital. And suppose initially I put in $10,000. So I've got $10,000 invested in the markets and the other 50% in cash. And then in this bull market that we've seen, I'm looking at all my friends getting rich. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing being an idiot, staying off from the sidelines with 50% cash? So I'm going to go in 90%. I'm going to ride this bull out. What's your response to that?
Well, two responses. One, if you're a person that's going to be having money to put in every year the rest of your life, you could have more in the market and you could be wrong because you're going to be averaging out every year if you're going to put more money in. For so many investors though, they have a lump sum of money. They can't do that. This is what they have. They retired on it. Mm-hmm. They sold a company. Something's happened. But for somebody in the situation you're speaking about, the only thing I would say is this, and that is if that other 90% got cut in half, I'll use it that example.
Okay.
Then ask yourself how you would feel. And if you say, well, that really wouldn't work for me. I wouldn't want to end up with that working like that. I'd like to have a little less than that. Okay. You give them an extreme example. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but you always give them extreme because it could happen. And that way they can get to where they want to. We like stocks long term, but you have to know, when to put in more and when to put in less, I think. And that's where we are now.
Psychologically, it hurts more to miss out on gains than it is to actually lose money. I've noticed that.
Now it does. It does. But if you look at the studies that have been done over the years, losses are twice as more painful than gains in the long run. Right now, what happens is every time you go to a dinner party or you go see one of your friends and they're saying, well, I bought X and now it's 10X. You're like, I'm missing out on the riches here. And I can't, but that's what happens when markets are really frothy.
Yeah.
But if you look at any psychological book about gains and losses, they'll tell you that losses hurt generally twice as much as gains. And that's why people sell out at the low. They can't take it. You rarely see anybody do anything crazy at the high because they feel good, but the emotion of that is to put more money in and then just keeps on working. But at the low, it hurts.
Right. One final point. You do have another book. It's called Rich Kids, Poor Kids. All right.
Yeah, rich kids, broke kids, huh?
Rich kids, broke kids. My apologies. Okay. Well, I think the name speaks for itself, but why don't you give us a bit of a synopsis here of what that is? And there is a very important message that ties back to investing.
Well, David, we've written a lot of books and on different topics of selling your business, different things. But one of the things we wanted to write on a number of years ago We found that people that have extraordinary wealth, particularly in the first generation, they sell a business, something goes on, they don't do a great job of getting that wealth correctly down to the second generation and particularly the third. And it typically has to do with when we come into a second generation child that's, I say a child, but an adult that inherited the money, or third generation. Many times we see the third generation, they'll say, well, my grandparents had a lot of money. They were mega wealthy. But the second generation spent most of it, and then we spent the rest of it. And so we don't have a lot of money. And it has to do with teaching the next generation how to handle money. And the one main thing I use in there is I say this: no matter how much money you have, you need to make your children work. You need to make them get a job, learn how to work, okay? Learn how to appreciate the dollar that they make, okay? And then they'll appreciate the dollar that you have. But if you just give them lump sums of money, they never have any appreciation for what it took to get there. And the biggest thing about this is when you make them stand on their own two feet, it's hard on you because you could make it easy for them. You really could. You could say, hey, here's the new car, here's a new house, you and your wife, they don't have to do anything. But if you'll make them stand on their own two feet, work, do their own work, it will help their own self-esteem so that when they're 45 years old and then they get some money, they'll think, you know, I'm going to really take care of this money because I know how hard it is to get it. And I think that's one of the big mistakes that people make. But we talk a lot about that because people really don't have the fortitude or the ability to say, hey, I'm not going to do that. I know in my own situation, I paid my friends who had businesses to work my kids from the time they were 11 or 12 years on until they could get insured by a company and then they had their own job. My children never knew it. They never knew it. I gave cash money and I said, you pay them a paycheck just like they were working. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It goes a long way.
So Ted, then final question. Let's talk about wealth preservation. Let's talk about leaving an inheritance for, let's say, your grandchildren. If you had to leave an asset that you think would stand the test of time for more than one generation, let's say two generations, what could that be?
Well, certainly, David, any branded company, and I'll use some examples. If you had a distributorship that was only for a territory that you owned and nobody else could be in that, that's typically the kind of thing you don't want to sell. You can pass that down because nobody can ever enter that territory. The second part of it is that if you are able to, I particularly like real estate because real estate teaches a lot of things. It teaches how to finance, it teaches leasing, teaches interaction with people and all those sorts of things. So if I were leaving one thing, I would leave income-producing real estate to my second generation.
Oh, fantastic. All right, Ted. Thank you for your thoughts. Good luck with your new book, and let me know when you have another one lined up, ready to go, and available to the public. Thank you for coming on Kitco today.
All right, David. Thank you.
Thank you for watching Kitco News. I'm David Lin. Cycle.